Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Xavier Brandon, an honor student at New Albany High School, was on his way to an afternoon preseason football practice when he was called from behind. This was back in May. When he turned around, a police officer was pointing a gun at him. There and then, he was handcuffed and made to lay on the ground and was asked whether he had any jewelry in his backpack. He did not. This episode had been preceded by a burglary earlier that day, and after a neighbor spotted Xavier Brandon walking through the neighborhood, his presence was reported to police. The scene recalled another confrontation about a year earlier when a neighborhood watch member actually shot and killed another young black man. That case is in trial in Florida now. The shooter claims he did so in self-defense. Many others believe it was an act inspired by unwarranted fear and prejudice and profiling. Is this a post-racial America? Many, many think not. And these kinds of examples are why they think that way. Xavier Brandon's case won't go to trial because there was no arrest or report filed of the event. But he believes the treatment was excessive, and he also believes that he was a target because he's black. Coming up, we'll hear from the Columbus Division of Police. They won't comment on this incident because an internal affairs complaint has been filed, but we'll hear about their usual protocol in such cases. Joining us now in the studio is Xavier Brandon and his mother, Jo Brandon Jones. Welcome to the show, Xavier.
Thank you very much.
And Jo, welcome as well.
Thank you for having us.
Okay, so Xavier, if we can just take it at that, what happened between the time you were walking down the street and you saw the neighborhood guy and you said hello to him?
Yes, ma'am.
What happened from that point to the point that I got to where the police had the gun leveled at you?
Well, after I said, "How are you doing, sir?" he responded with, "I am doing fine." And I continued to walk, and I saw that this gentleman was walking parallel with me, and he asked me, "What am I doing?" And I turned back in a confused manner, saying as though he's a stranger. So I told him I was I'm just walking, and he didn't respond. And I continued to walk along my route, and he said, "Hello, is this 911?" And I turned back really quickly when I heard that, and he said, "Sorry, this is the wrong number." So I continued on my path on the sidewalk, of course, and then when I went through Thompson, I hit the sidewalk on Thompson Road. And as I was walking, I wasn't really thinking about anything. I wasn't walking in a hurried manner. I was just walking very normal, very calm.
On your way to football practice?
Yes, ma'am, because I knew my time. So all of a sudden, I heard behind me, "Get down on the ground now." And I turned around very quickly, and I put my hands up, and I saw a police officer with a gun pointed at me. So I didn't think anything else. I just remember what my mother had told me before, and I was just calm. So I just got down.
What had your mother told you before?
She just told me, be respectful, do what you're told, and don't do anything serious. And, of course, I was familiar with the Trayvon case, so I knew.
Trayvon Martin case.
Yes, ma'am. So I knew any sudden movement could cause me to be physically harmed by this police officer. So I just got down, as you said.
You told the Columbus Dispatch, or Columbus Dispatch reporter, that you were a little insulted that anyone in New Albany would think that you were a threat. And I wondered, given the Trayvon Martin case, he is that's the name of the young black man who was shot and killed down in Florida by George Zimmerman. He's been charged as second-degree murder in that shooting death. If you've ever felt that someone treated you differently because you're black before, you said you remember what your mom said, but was that in terms of being black, or was that just in terms of being a youth, and if a police officer is stopping you for some reason, you're always respectful?
It was in terms of being safe. However, my mother has made me aware, and of course I have been able to see on my own, that being African-American at such a young age, and I play football, so I'm quite large. However, I am aware that certain things can be blamed on me, and I know sometimes African-Americans may have the worst hand dealt, and someone could blame anything on them. And I'm just aware that being an African-American, not everything's perfect, and I understand that certain things can happen in a situation where I might not be at fault, but I could be falsely accused and maybe even punished.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guests in the studio is Xavier Brandon, the New Albany High School student who was detained by Columbus police back in May on his way to football practice. Also, Jo Brandon Jones, his mother. If you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Jo, Brandon Jones, I read that you were angry when nothing was filed, that there was no charges, there was no report filed. tell us about the timeline. I know that you were another police officer recognized you, said, no, that's Xavier Brandon. He's okay. And he took you to football practice that day.
Yes, ma'am.
Joe, how did you find out, and why were you angry that there were no charges filed?
Well, actually, Ms. Fisher, I had just spoken with my son, because we do have a close relationship, and I had just gotten off the telephone with him at 12:17.
Before all of this occurred?
Before any of this occurred. And the time frame between it was 12:17 till exactly 1:17 when he called me. And he was actually going to the Drug Mart to go get a money order to purchase for his football camp. And I was reminding him. And he told me then that he was going to walk to school. He had enough time, and this is the route. And so I was angry because, just as Trayvon Martin's mother may have felt, or his father, they expected their child to be where they thought they would be with no incident or occurrence. And I was upset because they held him like he was a caged bird, and then they let him go as if it was nothing. And they impacted his life so tremendously that day and that time. And they could go on with their lives, but he couldn't go on with his life. He was supposed to have been studying for his exams, and he had all of that on his mind, and now he's faced with something he didn't really have to be faced with.
It was during final exams. That's why you were out and about at an odd time.
Yes, ma'am.
During the day.
Well, actually, Ann, it wasn't an odd time. It was 12 o'clock in the afternoon, and they had seniors that got out a week before that. So that's really not an odd time.
During finals week, it's not an odd time. Right,
right. So he was out because he was exempt from his exams. So I was angry because they treated it as if it was nothing, and it was so common, and they expected him to be relaxed behind this. So I was angry because they really didn't take it seriously, that this was a minor they dealt with, and they didn't contact myself either.
Okay. Once again, we're going to be talking with a representative from the Columbus Division of Police coming up in the next segment. So if you have a question for them, you can give us a call at 614-292-8513 at that time. Lots of people talked about how the election of Barack Obama, and you were still, you were just a kid, but how that election, of Barack Obama to the presidency put us at the threshold, if not maybe inside the door of a post-racial society. And most agree now that hasn't been the case. What did you think the impact of his election might be or not? Or what do you make of that whole post-racial notion from where you're sitting right now, Joe?
Well, I don't even know why the term exists, really, because we're never, ever going to actually be in a post-racial era. However, we can improve and we can show growth and development in our country and hopefully in individuals. And I feel as though the election of President Barack Obama is a great glass ceiling breaker, but is definitely not a post-racial incident.
Xavier, you're the generation coming up. What do you make of that notion of post-racial and the election of Barack Obama and going forward?
In my opinion, I do believe since he was elected, it is a pretty great achievement. However, I believe post-racial may never come due to because you cannot. I don't personally believe that it'll ever be over. It may improve, and I do believe people can change. And in my own opinion, certain people who you may say might be racist, such as Caucasian people or any other people, I have friends who are Caucasian. I believe there are a lot of people who aren't racist. However, no one will truly ever always.
Yeah, because what do we mean by racist and post-racial anyways? The profiling thing, researchers say that it's ingrained that we're all have certain profiles in our mind, and you're going to be hyper aware or on alert when you see a certain something happening. And so, it doesn't matter. Everybody does.
Right. Absolutely. I agree with that 100%. And sometimes it's just human nature. But it's okay when you're aware of it and you know how to prevent it and not put application to it. It's okay to be human, but know how to apply yourself in any given circumstance or situation.
Ronald in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Ronald.
Hi. I agree with what you just said there, but I think especially when you look at the Martin case, we have to have the ability to put ourselves in somebody else's shoes. And I think every time there's a major crime, and I don't want to say every time because first of all, I think it will get better over time if we keep on using our heads and keep on talking about it. Compared to when I was a kid, people get along a lot better. The cops are a lot better compared to when I was a kid. But I often think in this Martin case, if a white guy was walking through my neighborhood and I called the police and they told me not to follow him, and I followed him and he ended up dead, me being black, that would be murder one. It would be no question I would be convicted. And it's like they're talking about everything except that simple fact. This black kid was walking through that neighborhood doing nothing. Somebody followed him after the police told him not to follow him, and he ended up dead. And I think that's where this racism, you know, look at the fact that people, there's thousands of people convicted of crimes, and nobody goes out and has this big fund to defend them. If you're white, ask yourself why you're sending money to defend Zimmerman. Well, you don't know what happened there.
Okay.
That's the racist motivation.
All right. Ronald, thanks for your call. I want to get to one more before we have to close down for this segment. So thank you.
All right.
Take care.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Kurt and Powell, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. I just wanted to comment more so out of empathy for the young man. I think the larger society doesn't appreciate the fact that just being stopped by a policeman can have an ongoing emotional impact on a person, particularly when you're talking about someone who was minding their own business, did nothing to attract the attention of the police. It's something we understand when we get pulled over while driving, and we know that we become ultra introspective during our driving, but we don't seem to acknowledge the similar impact that it has on these young men who get stopped, these black young men who get stopped for no reason. So regardless to what the policeman's motivation may have been, it does impact that young man significantly.
All right, Kurt, thanks for your call.
Thanks.
Take care. The police have said that the review likely will take months to complete. What do you want the police to do, Xavier? What do you want from them at this point?
At this point, I would indeed like a apology from the man and also the policeman due to his actions, which may have caused me physical harm and which has honestly caused me somewhat mental instability.
Do you walk through that neighborhood anymore?
I do, and I will continue to do so just because, I mean, it is still the safest route, and I do believe that things happen, and I'm not afraid to just continue my normal route and do the same thing I always do, which is nothing.
When the other police officer recognized you, you're a member of, you know, you're on the same football team as his kid is, did anybody say at that point, oh, gee, sorry?
No, ma'am. No one apologized. And at that time, I wasn't really thinking about it because a gun was just pulled on me and I could think about nothing but just trying to get to my destination to contact my mother. But afterwards, it somewhat frustrated me because I feel as though things could have went seriously wrong. And when I saw my mother, the thing that angers me most is the fact that she was crying on my shoulder. And at that point, that's when I realized that it's very serious and my life could have been changed and the people around me were affected, and I want it to be taken seriously.
Were you let go at the scene, or did they take you down to the police station or some?
I was let go at the scene, mm-hmm. and the police officer that recognized me took me to the school where I contacted my mother, and then I walked around the corner to a Wendy's where she left her job immediately after me calling her, and she came and got me.
So, Joe, it still gets you kind of upset, I know.
Yeah.
I can see.
Yes. It was just holding my baby at that point because within an hour, less than an hour ago, I had spoken to him, all was well. And I really didn't expect my son to call me and tell me that, you know, this occurred and to the extent that it occurred, because you expect this to happen. Of course, he's a young man. You expected it to happen at some point in his life. Unfortunately, we do have to have these conversations with our young men, or particularly black males. But I didn't expect it to happen to him so soon. And I felt good that I could hold my baby, because I'm sure Trayvon Martin's mom wanted to hold her baby one last time as well. And unfortunately, he's a silent victim. And so I did not want Xavier to be a victim and who's able to speak out. So we appreciate you having us here today, giving us the opportunity to vindicate Xavier and to help him in his healing from this incident.
Well, we called you, so we appreciate you joining us in the studio today. Xavier Brandon, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Also, his mother, Jo Brandon Jones, thanks for joining us as well, Jo.
Thank you.
Coming up, we're going to hear from the Columbus Division of Police about this case, then move on the conversation, move on to the issue of racial profiling in the criminal justice system and in society at large, and what some people had hoped might be a quote-unquote post-racial society by now, but most agree now it is not. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Support comes from OSU's Department of Neurology, conducting a planned emergency study to see if progesterone can improve the outcome of a traumatic brain injury or TBI. Details on the PROTECT study, including a community opinion survey, and how to opt out of the study are at protectiii.com.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the Next On Point, a radical rethink on paying for college in Oregon. Free while you're there, maybe 3% of your income for 25 years after one state's stab at a national crisis. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
This afternoon at 1 on 89.7 NPR News. The WOSU Member Card Benefit of the Month for July is the Columbus Children's Theater. Enjoy two-for-one admission all month long. Visit WOSU.org.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Today we're talking about the hopes for a post-racial society after the election of Barack Obama to the presidency in 2008 and his re-election last year, and the reality in the wake of last November. Coming up, we'll hear from the author of a new book about why a post-racial society is unlikely in America. We just finished talking with the 16-year-old New Albany High School honor student who was held at gunpoint and handcuffed by police after someone reported him in the neighborhood after a burglary in May. The teen was later released without charges or a report filed about the incident. Since then, a complaint alleging excessive force has been filed with the Internal Affairs Department of the Columbus Police Division. So the police won't comment on this case specifically, but joining us now by phone right now is Sergeant Rich Weiner. He's a spokesman for the Columbus Division of Police to talk about police protocol in such circumstances. Welcome to the show, Sergeant Weiner.
Good morning, Ann.
So tell us about what happens. What is the protocol when you get a call like this?
Well, the first thing you have to understand, every call is going to be different. It'll mm-hmm. be judged on its face.
Okay.
In a situation like this, we can, based upon the information given to the dispatchers from the caller, that information is relayed to the officers, and then they will rely on their training to approach that individual, and it is our job to investigate crimes. So it's very difficult for the officers because we deal more with the unknown than we do the known.
In that case, and I know you don't specifically going to talk about it, but I until today I had the impression that the burglary had already been reported. Has there been a reported burglary?
What happened was there was a call from a neighbor who stated his neighbor's door had been kicked in. He was outside. He saw an individual who looked suspicious. Wasn't sure if they were involved with it, but that individual looked suspicious in nature. There was very descriptive clothing given to the dispatchers who relayed that to the officers. Mm-hmm. This caller went even further and said, hey, you know what, I'm going to follow him until officers get here.
Now, is that something that a dispatcher would recommend to somebody who's reporting something like this?
Well, you know, we ask the public for help all the time, but we don't want them to put themselves into any type of danger. You know, okay. If you can do it from a safe distance, that's great. But we don't want anybody to approach somebody. That's what our job is.
Okay, so forgetting about this case for the moment, we've talked about racial profiling before. It's a conversation that's occurred many times in the past. We know what we're talking about when it comes to the criminal justice system. We know, as the mother of Xavier said earlier, and with one of the callers said, things are better with police. Things are a lot better with police. What kind of training do police get in the Columbus Division of Police to avoid racial profiling, or is the division of the opinion that racial profiling is a rational way of police strategy, a rational police strategy?
Well, number one, you have to look at the fact that there's two kinds of profiling. One is bias-based profiling, also commonly referred to as racial profiling. And bias-based profiling is really factors the race, ethnicity, and bias towards anybody of a religion, race, ethnic background. So there is a difference between the two.
Okay.
Now, as far as our training goes annually, we just wrapped up a roll call training where supervisors go over bias-based profiling, the do's and don'ts. And basically it comes down to, you know, you have to treat everybody based upon their actions and not who they are, what they are, what they represent.
But ultimately, that's always going to vary in the mind of the eye of the beholder.
Absolutely. And you said at the beginning, you know, police officers have, or law enforcement have, come a long way, mm-hmm. but there's still so much more progress that could be made.
Okay. Sergeant Richard Weiner, thanks for joining us today. We really appreciate it.
Thanks, Ann.
Take care. That's Sergeant Richard Weiner. He's a spokesman for the Columbus Division of Police. Joining us now by phone from New York in just a second, as soon as we get them put on the air, is F. Michael Higginbotham. He teaches law at the University of Baltimore and is the author of Ghosts of Jim Crow, Ending Racism in Post-Racial America. Welcome to the show, Michael.
It's good to be on the show, particularly to talk about such an important issue as post-racial America and racial profiling.
You wrote about the idea of a post-racial America back just before Barack Obama was first elected president in 2008. Actually, it's probably about 6 months before that. Already, magazine covers were asking whether his rise meant the end of racism. And you said that it depended on what Americans did with the opportunity, that it was the fourth great opportunity in our history. What were the other three?
Well, we've had three really key points in our history: the American Revolution and the starting of the Constitution, the Reconstruction period after the Civil War, and then the Civil Rights movement and the laws passed during the late 50s and early 60s in this country. Three opportunities to really change, fundamentally change American inequality. And we didn't get there. We made some progress, and people need to understand that. We've ended Jim Crow segregation. We've passed anti-discrimination laws, and we've implemented affirmative action programs. But progress doesn't mean post-racial. Race is still significant in our society today in terms of opportunities and hardships endured by individuals.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. No one would suggest that South Africa is post-racial either, but they did do something that we've never done in this country. They had a structured conversation about it.
And I think that that would be good for us to do as well. They had a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, a formal process where individuals would discuss race and would discuss the discrimination that had occurred in the past. And that way you get to the truth of what is going on in our society. And I think that is a very, very important thing for all societies with a history of racial discrimination to do, including our society.
What would that conversation be like here if it ever occurred? How do you envision it for this country?
Well, certainly I think it should be a process that includes all sides, as your program indicates. I mean, it should be a process that includes Democrats and Republicans, conservatives and liberals, all sides of the political spectrum, all races, creeds, colors, religions. I mean, this society is a very diverse society, mm-hmm. and it needs to also, of course, be a very inclusive society. The process, I think, would be one where states, communities within states would have opportunities where people could come and present their ideas and discuss them, as well as hearings before Congress and our legislative bodies in particular states, similar to what transpired in South Africa.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. And my guest right now, Michael Higginbotham, he teaches law at the University of Baltimore, and he's the author of a new book. It's called Ghosts of Jim Crow, Ending Racism in Post-Racial America. Now, in that subtitle, Michael Higginbotham, post-racial is in quotation marks?
It is not, because many think that we're already in a post-racial society, but we haven't gotten there yet.
Many think that, but many also think not.
And I believe they are correct. The subtitle of the book, Ending Racism in Post-Racial America, basically says we can get there. There's a mechanism, a formula for getting there, but we've got to be willing to take those steps. And from my standpoint, there has been a racial model in this country, and it's been in existence since slavery times, and it involves false notions of racial hierarchy, including notions of white superiority and black inferiority. It includes notions of isolation and separation of the races, and also of victimization. And I think we need to attack that model. We need to eradicate that model. And until we do, we're never going to get to be a post-racial society. We haven't done it yet.
How does this play into, in pretty concrete terms, our criminal justice system?
Well, I think, you know, discussion of racial profiling is really, really important. The Officer Weiner had mentioned earlier about aspects of profiling and about what's permitted and what's prohibited. I think it's very important for listeners to understand that description of identification is fine. I mean, a racial description for a specific identification of a person, that's fine. But race should never be used as a proxy for suspicion. And I think that's what the officer was talking about. In particular cases where individuals are suspicious of someone simply because of their race, that is unacceptable. And it's really, really problematic in our society today. And if we really want to get to a post-racial society, we need to eliminate race as being a proxy for suspicion.
Suspicion, and I haven't looked it up, but it's more, to me, of an emotion. It's an emotional response to something.
Well, and clearly, I mean, clearly human beings are emotional, but what needs to occur, of course, is that people need to make sure it's not in their heads, it's not in their minds, that because someone is black or because someone is white, that alone causes a suspicion level in their minds. That is unacceptable. And if individuals are profiling people, or law enforcement is profiling people based upon their race, and that is the proxy for suspicion, it is really problematic. It's something that I think all of us need to fight against. Mm-hmm. Certainly, you know, we all have biases and prejudices, mm-hmm. and we need to fight against those biases and prejudices, particularly when it comes to race, because we have been educated and bombarded with notions of racial inferiority, with notions of racial hierarchy. And it's really, really problematic. We need to fight against it.
You know about the case in Columbus we were talking about earlier on the show.
I read an article on it yesterday.
I wonder, and it's kind of looking at it from a generic point of view, if we could for a moment, what if the gentleman who called the police had said, before he called him and asked the kid, where are you going? Why aren't you in school? I'm headed to football practice. Oh, I mean, taking it a step further, gotten to know him a little bit more about what he was doing. Would you endorse something like that or not?
Well, you know, it gets really, really tricky because, as Officer Weiner talked about, you want to make sure that no civilian puts themselves in jeopardy. And so you have to be very, very careful.
And and conversely, Xavier Brandon said, you know, he was he was a stranger to him. He felt kind of odd talking to him.
And that, of course, is a concern that anytime you are on the street, anytime you're in public, individuals may have legitimate reasons to be fearful of other individuals. But the fact that somebody would look at an individual and say they're suspicious simply because of their race is problematic. And so if the individual looked out of his window and saw a black person and said that person looks suspicious and calls the police because the person is black, and that is the proxy for suspicion, that is problematic and it should not occur. It should never occur. Now, if the person is suspicious because of their behavior, irrespective of their color, that's very different. And so suspicion because of behavior, somebody's walking around peeping in windows, they are suspicious, whether they are white or black. And therefore, a call to the police to investigate that person would be fine. But it's behavior that should cause the suspicion, not race.
Judith in Columbus, you are on the air with Michael Higginbotham. Welcome to the show.
Hi, I just turned on the television and saw your show, Racial Profiling, which I have been fighting against for years. I'm an activist in Columbus, Ohio. However, my question is, and my concern has always been, you hire all these recruits, okay, they come from, you know, many different places.
To the police force.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes they have no dealings, the new recruits. They didn't grow up with blacks. They don't know anything about blacks other than what they hear and what they've read. And then you give them a gun and you put them in the black community. Well, that's a flag for disaster right there. Listen, why is it the black Americans are the only race of people that have to have the Voting Act renewed every 25 years if everything was equal? Everything is not equal.
Well, I mean, that's what we've been talking about as far as the post-racial thing. But, Judith, thanks for your call. Michael, we're gonna keep you with us. I wanted to read an email from Avery before we take a break. Avery writes from Delaware. We are not in a post-racial America. African Americans are disproportionately represented in the prison population, mostly due to the war on drugs, when they are no more likely to use or sell drugs as white people. I am white, and I am aware of my privilege, and do not buy that African Americans are getting all these benefits from society. They are still getting the short end of the stick. The election of Barack Obama was a step in the right direction, but I would argue things are worse now because of all the vocalized racism we see on the internet and in the media. That's an interesting thing that we haven't brought up yet, is that there's this new venue for racism.
Well, there's no question there are huge disparities, not only in terms of the criminal justice system, but throughout the spectrum of our society. Whether it be in terms of wealth accumulation, there's a 20-to-1 disparity between white and black in terms of wealth accumulation in families today. There is tremendous inequality in how we fund our public schooling, and minority students are disproportionately harmed by that. As the caller mentions, there's tremendous disparities in terms of the prison population, in terms of arrests, in terms of sentencing, whether it be in capital sentencing or in other sentencing. And so these huge disparities are alarming. And when you think about post-racial, these disparities are sort of an indication that we definitely are not there yet. The previous caller also, I think, mentioned something very important, and that is we really have to train our officers on the profiling aspect and what's permissible and what is not permissible. Because, as the caller indicated, we are separate in many respects in terms of housing. We're very much racially segregated today. And what is important that occurs is proper training and education of our officers to respect individuals irrespective of race and to make certain that they treat everyone the same irrespective of race. And to me, that's very, very important that our officers receive the proper training. It's a tough job to do.
I was going
to
say easier said than done. Michael Higginbotham, you'll stay with us. We will take a break and continue our conversation. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Support comes from Opera Project Columbus, presenting Puccini's only comic opera, Johnny Schicchi, conducted by maestro Alessandro Siciliani and directed by Classical 101's own Christopher Purdy. Performances are June 15th and 16th at the Jewish Community Center. Tickets at operaprojectcolumbus.org.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Next time on Here and Now, a new book blends Star Wars and Shakespeare. Wonder what he'd think about that.
He'd say you're no Shakespeare, but I do think he would enjoy it. Shakespeare had a great sense of humor, and I think would have enjoyed sort of the spirit behind this book.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon from 2 till 4 on 89.7 NPR News.
Support comes from Wexner Heritage Village, home of geriatric planning solutions. Now there's a GPS for families navigating the complex and changing landscape of senior health care. More on Wexner Heritage Village's geriatric planning solutions at whv.org.
As a basic member of 89.7 NPR News, you'll receive a one-year subscription to our airfare program guide, either by mail or email, the WOSU FYI e-newsletter, and a reusable WOSU grocery tote. A basic membership starts at just $60. Visit WOSU.org, and thanks for your support.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about stereotypes in the criminal justice system and the dream of a post-racial society in America. Can the first be eradicated, and can the second ever be achieved? Joining us now by phone from California is Jack Glazer. He's a social psychologist who researches stereotyping, prejudice, and discrimination, and teaches public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Still with us, Michael Higginbotham, author of Ghosts of Jim Crow, Ending Racism in Post-Racial America. Jack Glazer, you decided to study racial profiling after reading an article by a prominent scholar that argued that there is a rationale for it in policing strategy. I brought that up earlier in the program. Can you tell us about that argument of rationale for it in the policing strategy?
Yeah, this particular argument was saying that it's unconstitutional, and every constitutional expert I've ever talked to agrees, but sort of stipulated that it's an efficient, rational strategy for police to be looking at groups that they, for one reason or another, believe to be committing offenses at a higher rate, and so they should be concentrating their resources there. Of course, that's fraught with all kinds of dubious assumptions.
And so how did you take this and turn it into a study on the effects of profiling?
Well, the first thing that I wanted to do was just to see whether there was any validity to that argument. And so I set about trying to look for data that would help me test whether police departments that are engaged in profiling or officers who are engaged in profiling are being more effective in terms of capturing more criminals and deterring more crime and all that. And the first thing I discovered was that those data are really not available. We don't, for one thing, know what rate departments are profiling at, and then we also don't know what rate individuals or groups are violating crimes at or offending at. So we were missing some key pieces of information. I started out by just doing some mathematical simulations to see what would happen under very conservative assumptions. And one of the major findings was that even if police target groups that are offending at higher rates, and this is just an assumption we made in the model that I ran, even when they're targeting groups that are offending at substantially higher rates, the long-term benefits of profiling in terms of capturing more criminals are very modest, and they can even be ironic if it's disproportionate to the offending. The more troubling finding was that regardless of what the offending rates are. So regardless of whether minorities and whites are offending at differential rates, if police profile, no matter what the offending rates, they will create disproportions in the criminal justice system that are disproportionate even to the differences in offending. So even if we say, oh, this group is offending at a higher rate, they commit, you know, 10% of them are carrying illegal drugs or weapons at any given time, and the police profile them, they will get incarcerated at a rate that's higher than their relative rate of offending. So it will create the very disparities that are being used to justify it in the first place.
So the disproportions that you talk about then aren't disproportions between the races. It's disproportions with or between the groups. It's disproportions within a group that what actually might be happening out there, it's higher. Why is that?
Well, what the disproportion is that the profiling itself causes people to be caught at a rate that's higher than they would be if police were just looking for people who are engaging in suspicious behavior. And as soon as they use some kind of mental shortcut, like a stereotype, then they get away from the valuable information of the person's actual behavior, and their judgments become less accurate.
Michael Higginbotham, this is what we were talking about, behavior versus a racial note or a kind of an ethnic note.
I think it's really important, the research that's going on, as the professor mentions, you do the racial profiling. So there may be disproportionality that you start with, but it makes it worse once you racial profile. So I think that's really important research. So if this is an inefficient way to go about it, the other aspect is it's un-American. And I think the professor mentioned from a constitutional standpoint, this profiling has been going on for centuries. As I talk about in Ghosts of Jim Crow, it goes back to 1806 in Hudgens versus Wright case, where free blacks were profiled and presumed to be slaves. And for the 20,000 free blacks that were in the state of Virginia at the time, it was a denial of their humanity. It was a denial of their due process rights under the Constitution. And so even if this was an efficient way to go about law enforcement, and the research seems to suggest it is not an efficient way, it is un-American and it violates notions of due process that all Americans, irrespective of their color, are entitled to.
Jack Glazer, a lot of this has to do with police resources, we hear, that they can't be everywhere all the time. You know, as the old joke goes, you know, there's never a police officer around when you need one. And so that's where the efficiency issue comes in. They're saying we're doing this because we don't have enough resources and we have to focus them.
That's correct. I mean, and that's a fair argument. They definitely have finite resources. And, for example, nearby here in Oakland, they're terribly understaffed and they're not even able to patrol, and a lot of their beats are left unpatrolled. So it's a real issue, and the question becomes what's the best way to maximize efficiency, and profiling is a really tempting one for people because it seems very logical. The problem, again, is that we don't necessarily know. The assumptions that officers make about who's engaged in crime are often based on the criminal justice statistics that are created by the profiling in the first place. But they also are based on the same stereotypes that the rest of us are vulnerable to. And some of those are driven by what's going on in the media and in literature and in daily conversations. But they're rarely based on careful statistical analysis. The other problem is that as soon as you start arguing in favor of efficiency, you acknowledge that if you are doing it for efficiency, you're diverting resources from one target population to another. So if they have fixed resources, they only have so many officers, they can only stop so many people during the day, then if they're stopping more African Americans, they're stopping fewer European Americans. And one of the arguments in favor of profiling is that it deters crime, that if the offenders know that they're being profiled, then they'll commit less crime. But the other side of that coin is that if offenders in the other populations who aren't profiled perceive a change in the cost of committing crime on their end because, more specifically, a drop in the cost of crime because other people are being policed more rigorously, then potentially they're going to commit more crime. And there's actually some archival evidence for that, and now I have some experimental lab-based evidence for that. We call it reverse deterrence.
Hmm. There is the End Racial Profiling Act. It was introduced in Congress in 2001. What would that do, and what are your hopes for its passage anytime soon, if ever?
I hope it gets passed, but I'm not at all optimistic about that. I don't think it's even received a floor vote, as far as I know. It's been introduced in the House and the Senate in every Congress, and it's got a fair number of sponsors, but it just doesn't seem to be able to gain any traction. And part of that is that there's pretty heavy police lobbying against it, in part because it places new requirements for data collection, and law enforcement people typically see that as a threat because it ties their hands and it makes their jobs more difficult. But I think there are some components to the End Racial Profiling Act that are promising. There are some block grants in there from the federal government to local departments to develop best practices. There are these data collection requirements. There are training requirements. It officially bans racial profiling, so there's a prohibition. But I think that there's a de facto ban in effect already. You won't find any departments that will acknowledge that they're profiling or will endorse it in any way. So it's it's a step in the right direction. It could have more teeth in it, but if it had more teeth in it, it would have an even less chance of a lower chance of getting passed. So again, I'm not optimistic.
You mentioned best practices. Do we have a sense of what those are?
We're working on that, and one of them is not just a lot of departments are collecting better data on who gets stopped. And in fact, San Jose just agreed to start collecting data on who gets on pedestrian stops in addition to vehicle stops. And that's a growing trend across the country. The problem is what we do with those data. And most departments analyze them internally and don't do a particularly rigorous job of that. And so they don't learn very much from it. So what I'm hopeful of is that there will become national standards for these kinds of data collections, who gets what we collect in terms of every pedestrian and vehicle stop that occurs, all kinds of demographic information, what was the rationale for the stop, et cetera. And then there will be some national standards for how those data are analyzed and some degree of accountability when we detect patterns that indicate racial profiling. It's a tall order, but the work needs to be done. The other side is on training, officer training.
Yeah.
There's no basis at this point, there's no empirical basis at this point for thinking that any of the training that's going on right now is actually mitigating racial bias in policing. So a lot of it looks good. It has high, what we would call face validity. Mm-hmm. It sounds like you're telling officers the right thing, but we just don't know that it's actually reducing biased policing.
I can't remember if I was reading it in your article or something else to prepare, but the reference to our officers get 19 hours of training, and I think that's in a career before they hit the streets. And I was kind of thinking 19 hours of training. Yeah, on this topic. And I was thinking 19 hours of training after, as Michael Higginbotham, you pointed out, hundreds of years of patterns being set doesn't seem like a lot to me.
That's a good point. I think Professor Higginbotham wanted to jump in there.
Yeah, I think it's very important. We need much better training and longer training. And I also think we need, diversity. We need to make sure that our police forces reflect our community in terms of racial, ethnic, and other types of diversity, gender, religious diversity. So I think that's very important, and that in and of itself will be a helpful learning process. When you have officers interacting with other officers who are of different races, that may be very helpful in terms of not only the perception in the community, as the earlier caller talked about, but also how the officers behave themselves.
And we're
I want to agree with that heartily. Intergroup contact is one of the best demonstrated methods for reducing stereotyping and prejudice.
And we're talking about officers now, but the trial going on down in Florida regarding the shooting death of Trayvon Martin didn't involve a police officer. It involved a community crime watch person. how do we even begin to, and those are expanding because of the limited resources of police departments. Community watch groups are expanding now. How do we even get to that then?
The racial profiling can occur from civilians as well as from police officers. And so when you mentioned the Zimmerman murder trial, the profiling occurred through Zimmerman, who was a neighborhood watch volunteer. And we have to, of course, be concerned and knowledgeable that the profiling can come in this way rather than being done by law enforcement.
Yeah, I just want to add that the reason why most police officers racially profile, I believe, is that they are normal human beings with normal human cognition, and part of that cognition is making judgments about individuals based on stereotypes of groups. And we can try to develop training to reduce that, and I think it's possible. But Professor Higginbotham is exactly right. They're just like everybody else in that regard. And so if you deputize other people effectively through these abominable stand your ground laws, then you're going to get that kind of behavior more widespread. And I want to just point out that at the root of the Zimmerman Trayvon Martin case is the stand your ground law, which is from a policy perspective an absolute disaster.
Well, this is a conversation we've had before, and I'm sure we'll have it again, but I want to thank you for joining it today. Dr. Jack Glazer, an associate professor of public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And also Michael Higginbotham, professor of law at the University of Baltimore and the author of Ghosts of Jim Crow, Ending Racism in Post-Racial America. Thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
And thanks to everybody for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus.